Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Michael, and good afternoon to everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice to order. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconference meeting. The focus of today's panel is community relations, training, and law enforcement. And we look forward to hearing from today's panel of subject matter experts. Yesterday's hearing was robust, and the witnesses provided a great deal of information and facts for this commission to deliberate and discuss. I'm sure today's hearing will be equally robust. This time, I'd ask the Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct a roll call of commissioners.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, I'd just like to once again remind everyone that today's event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have any questions or need clarification on anything, please contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I will call the roll. Commissioner Bowditch. Commissioner Clemens.
Present.
Commissioner Evans. Commissioner Frazier.
Present. Thank you.
Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
I'm present. Thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo.
I'm here, Jean. Thank you.
Commissioner McDonald.
Present. Thank you.
Commissioner Moody.
Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning.
Commissioner Parr. Where's
she? I'm here.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon. I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rout. Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
I'm here. Thank you.
And Commissioner Washington. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you, Dane. Any other announcements today?
No, sir. We are good to go.
Thank you. I do want to pass along to all the commissioners that Commissioner Dave Roush lost his brother last night after a battle with pancreatic cancer. He was a great man and veteran of our U.S. Navy. We'll keep Commissioner Roush in our thoughts and prayers, and we'll provide you an update by email soon about Commissioner Rouse's brother. We again want to acknowledge the continuing commitment of our commissioners, the working group members, witnesses that are here today, and those that have appeared in previous panels, as well as the federal staff, toward meeting the goals of this historic commission. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panels, and we'll then open for questions from commissioners after the last witness. We'll make one exception to that today with Dr. Lori Friedel, who has to leave after her testimony. Our first distinguished panelist today is Dr. Lori Friedel, Professor of Department of Criminology at the University of South Florida. Dr. Friedel is recognized as a subject matter expert in the psychology of bias and how bias might impact law enforcement professionals. She speaks routinely on a national basis on this topic and provides consultation and training to law enforcement agencies across the country. With law enforcement practitioners and national experts on psychology, on implicit bias and funding from the COPS office, she developed the document Fair and Impartial Training, Fair and Impartial Policing Training Program, which is the number one training program used by law enforcement in North America. Commissioners, please again note that Dr. Friedel will need to leave immediately after her testimony, and will entertain questions for her following her testimony. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Friedel, and you're recognized. Dr. Friedle?
Please make sure you have it placed your phone.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now, Dr. Friedle.
All right. So, Commissioners, President Trump's executive order that this commission was, quote, to study ways to make American law enforcement the most trusted and effective guardians of our communities. So I speak to you today about an important vehicle producing both community trust and policing effectiveness, and that is implicit bias training for police. As a brief science backdrop, let me share that society assumed for many years that prejudice took just one form, and we now know that as explicit bias. An example of explicit bias is a racist whose biases are conscious and whose discriminatory behavior is intentional. In 1989, the social psychologist discovered implicit bias, and we learned that even well-intentioned people have biases that can impact perceptions and behavior. So the purpose of implicit bias training is to bring this science to law enforcement. There is a range of quality of training programs, but to me, good implicit bias training is not accusatory. Instead, the objectives of a quality training program are to share the science of implicit bias, discuss how implicit bias might manifest in the law enforcement profession, and then provide the officers and deputies with skills to produce impartial policing.
Oh my gosh.
Now, regarding this last element, the skills needed vary by whether the training participants are officers, regarding this last element, the skills needed vary by whether the training participants are officers, supervisors, mid-managers, or command. Thus, for instance, for officers, we have to recognize that it's very difficult to eliminate our biases. But officers and deputies can be taught science-based skills to manage them. Supervisors need to not only manage their own biases, but they need skills and techniques for monitoring their direct reports for potential bias behavior and for intervening as appropriate when they suspect that bias behavior. So evidence of success for implicit bias training comes from two sources. First of all, from officers' own reports of the impact of the training. And second, social psychological research on the effectiveness of these programs for various target populations. In terms of officers' own reports, and again, there is a lot of variation in the quality of the programs, but our own program and others too get very positive reviews from police professionals. Often they enter the classroom defensive or even hostile, but overwhelmingly they rate the training as a 4 or 5 on a 5-point scale. Overwhelmingly, they report that the training will help them do their jobs better. We also know about the success of implicit bias training from a significant and growing body of social psychological research that demonstrates its effectiveness. This research documents that people who have had implicit bias training have increased bias awareness and concern about discrimination, have increased motivation to behave in a bias-free manner, and they commit to using bias management techniques. Most importantly, an increasing number of studies document changes in behavior. So what could this commission do? First and quite simply, the commission could recognize the importance of implicit bias training. It could encourage agencies across the nation to train their personnel in this topic. Second, the commission could recommend a federal grant program that will ensure that agency leaders, number one, receive impartial policing training customized for their leadership role, and second, technical assistance to help them strengthen their efforts to produce impartial policing. Such a federal program would recognize that in order to produce impartial policing in an agency, it requires more than just administering implicit bias training to line personnel. Various police leaders, trainers, academics have identified components of what I'm going to collectively call a comprehensive agency strategy to produce impartial policing. So what are the components of this comprehensive strategy? Just as examples, agency leaders, in order to strengthen their efforts to produce impartial policing, need to recruit individuals who can police in an unbiased fashion, implement safeguards to reduce internal bias, such as what might be associated with promotions and discipline, provide use of force training that reflects the science of implicit bias, and implement safeguards to ensure that operational directives do not inadvertently promote biased behavior. So a federal program could train agency leaders not just in the science of bias, but a comprehensive strategy for producing impartial policing. And this same program could produce and provide resources to facilitate implementation of such a strategy. So, for instance, a chief or sheriff in this program would receive the leadership level training, and then following that training, have access to people or other resources to help him or her, for instance, identify and adopt sample questions to use at hiring to identify applicants who can police in an unbiased fashion, reinforce the message of impartial policing with roll call videos, infuse implicit bias lessons into academy and in-service training. So this program could also provide bi-monthly updates to chiefs and sheriffs to advise them on promising practices as they are identified and inform them of what their colleagues around the nation are doing to promote impartial policing. So in closing, commissioners, I return to President Trump's charge to this commission. He asked you to identify ways to promote trust and effectiveness in law enforcement, and implicit bias training is critical to achieving both of those objectives. This commission could recognize the importance of implicit bias training and ensure that agency leaders have the information and resources that they need to implement a comprehensive program to produce impartial policing. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Fidel, for your testimony today and certainly for your service. Commissioners, we'll now open for questions for Dr. Fidel before she needs to leave the call. So we'll entertain questions now from commissioners.
Phil, this is Regina Lombardo with ATF. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Dr. Friedel, I know that I've met you before, and I know that you have delivered the training many years ago to ATF executives here, but I know also that you also do quite a bit of training on some of the local law enforcement that's out there. What has been your feedback so far on the training that you have provided to, I think, some of the bigger police departments like NYPD and others on the results and some of the effects?
Good. And so we did just finish a two-year project to implement implicit bias training to all 36,000 NYPD sworn personnel. And, you know, this was a tough implementation because it did come on the heels of the stop and frisk controversy. And so when we have a situation like that, we can expect a little bit of defensiveness or skeptical when we go into the classroom, and we do, but we made the sale because even in that environment, over 90% gave the training fours or fives, over 95% rated the trainers well, and what really stuck in my mind was 80% of the participants, and we did train from top to bottom, said that this training was going to help them do their work. And 80% said this training will help them personally. So, yeah, sometimes it's tough when we get into the classroom because we've accused police of being racist for so many years. They're defensive. But really, the feedback we've been getting has been overwhelmingly positive.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Other commissioners with questions? Other commissioners with questions for Dr. Friedel? Thank you, Dr. Friedel, for your testimony today and certainly for your service. And we appreciate you appearing for the panel today. We hope you have a great afternoon.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Our next distinguished panelist today is Chief Daniel Slaughter, who is the chief of the Clearwater Police Department in Florida. Chief Slaughter began his career with Clearwater Police Department in 1992 and rose through the ranks to become chief in August of 2014. He has an earned undergraduate degree from the University of South Florida, and he serves on the board of directors for the Police Executive Research Forum and is the 12th District Director for the Florida Police Chiefs Association. Thank you for joining us today, Chief Slaughter. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioners. Good afternoon. Just a little geography. City of Clearwater is 26 square miles in Pinellas County, Florida, that little peninsula that makes Tampa Bay. We have 245 officers, 125 civilians, and we serve a population of about 117,000. Our core organizational principles center around preservation of life, commitment to excellence, building community champions, and then following the principles of Sir Robert Peel. In order to build trust and legitimacy between communities and law enforcement agencies, I respectfully request the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice consider the following. Promote and encourage law enforcement culture to embrace their role of being a first responder with respect to being the first to defend and protect civil rights and basic human rights. Promote and encourage all law enforcement agencies to provide training in implicit bias. And promote and encourage all law enforcement agencies to establish programs that promote an intentional non-enforcement face-to-face contact between officers and citizens in neighborhoods of the greatest need. In Clearwater, we continue, we will and will always continue to be an agency that seeks to continually improve in the category of community trust. We believe that no level of community trust is enough, that we believe that people trust people and that people build relationships, not technology, and that the organizations benefit. The trust of police is going to be earned through the positive interactions of police officers with community members, one encounter at a time. And we believe that policing that is not bias-free reduces the community trust of the police. And we believe we need to promote tools that build an organizational culture that seeks to be bias-free. We know implicit bias will exist, and we all have it, but we also know that if we become aware of implicit bias, we can adjust our behavior or adapt around it. Simply put, a police organization must have an awareness of and accept the presence of implicit bias and use that knowledge to look for it and address it aggressively. A police department must make it clear during the hiring process and onboarding process of the organizational commitment to fair and impartial policing. Questions presented to police candidates are just as important to elicit a response as they are to communicate to the candidate the organizational values of the police department. The curriculum presented to the police candidates during an onboarding process also communicates to these new hires and these new police officers what the organizational's values are. For the Clearwater Police Department, this includes introducing new police officers to implicit bias training and the history of police work early on in the process. During the onboarding process, a new police officer with the Clearwater Police Department has provided a publication by Chuck Ramsey titled The Challenge of Policing in a Democratic Society, A Personal Journey Towards Understanding. In this publication, Chuck Ramsey educates the reader on the obligations of the police to be first responders when basic human and civil rights are threatened or denied. New police officers are required to write an impact statement on this article, which facilitates a discussion on ensuring these new officers understand their highest responsibility is to protect all life, treat people with dignity, and be the first person to object to violations of civil liberties or civil rights, including policing that is not bias-free. New Clearwater police officers are introduced to the concept of implicit bias. They're also, the training is reinforced by department policy and scenario-based training. The department conducts fair and impartial policing administrative reviews annually to review our policies and potential improvements and evaluate police activity data. However, police administrations must recognize that data should drive more questions and do deeper levels of analysis to search for problems and identify corrective actions. Additionally, at Clearwater, the management staff of the Clearwater Police Department receives regular reoccurring training in implicit bias at the command level. Law enforcement agencies have the responsibility to evaluate the potential damage to public trust that can occur when implementing a crime-fighting strategy, and to know that implicit bias exists is only part of the equation. Commanders and managers need to evaluate how this implicit bias could play a role in the crime-fighting strategy and ensure that strategy is in full agreement with a policy of bias-free policing. Law enforcement leaders cannot simply provide implicit bias training to staff, check a box, and suspect that it will improve community trust. Interestingly, but not surprising, certain strategies can reduce both or can both address bias and improve community trust. Contact theory indicates bias can be reduced by having positive contacts with counter stereotypes. And research has also shown that face-to-face non-enforcement interaction between police and community members in the areas of greatest need can build trust and satisfaction with the police. And in Clearwater, we accomplished both by a dedicated program where officers park their vehicle, walk the neighborhood, and talk to citizens, and they must do so in a non-enforcement manner. So in conclusion, the community trust is required for police departments to be effective. Public approval, respect of the public, and cooperation are words prevalent in the principles of Sir Robert Peel. Organizations need to continually evaluate the impact of the strategies and operations and how they can reinforce or reduce implicit bias in their workforce and in the public. And educating law enforcement on the history of policing and core principles of the profession and implicit bias will empower police officers to be the instrument of positive change the community continues to demand. Law enforcement leaders will need to be surgical in their policing strategies, continually evaluating those strategies to ensure they are bias-free and procedurally just. So I therefore reiterate my request the Commission consider, promote, and encourage law enforcement agencies to build healthy organizational cultures by training officers in their role as protectors of the Constitution, providing training in implicit bias, and implementing programs that create intentional non-enforcement engagements in communities with the greatest need. The current environment may have some believing that law enforcement profession is permanently broken, and I continue to believe that almost all police officers are the most noble people on the planet and willing to do a very complicated job for the betterment in our communities, and I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chief Slaughter, for your valued testimony, and certainly for your service to law enforcement. Our last distinguished panelist is Dr. David Klinger, who is professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. Prior to pursuing his graduate degree, Dr. Klinger worked as a patrol officer for the Los Angeles Police Department and the Redmond, Washington Police Department. In 1997, he was a recipient of the American Society's Criminology's inaugural Ruth Caven Young Scholar Award for outstanding early contribution to the discipline of criminology. He has published scholarly manuscripts that address arrest practices, the use of force, how features of the community affect the actions of patrol officers, and terrorism. His book, Into the Kill Zone, A Cop's Eye View of Deadly Force, was published in 2004. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Klinger. You're now recognized.
Thank you for having me. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, sir.
Very good. The previous two panelists talked about aspects of culture in American law enforcement, and I want to talk about a different aspect of culture. And the primary goal of my testimony today is to further understanding among the commissioners and others who might have already looked at my written testimony about the need to develop something called safety culture in American law enforcement via developing a mindfulness in police agencies and police officers. And the reason I think this is so important is that the flashpoint for so much of the tension between American law enforcement and the American polity is when police officers exercise their coercive powers. And one of the things that we know from both research and experience, and I outlined some of the research in my opening paragraphs of my written testimony, is that when police officers practice sound field tactics, they can reduce the levels of violence between themselves and citizens, everything from minor levels of violence all the way up through and including the use of deadly force. And one of the problems that we have is that despite the fact that we understand that sound field tactics, and when I say field tactics, I mean how police officers deploy, the words that they choose, how they work together to resolve a potentially tenuous or violent situation. We know that there's certain things they can do, but officers don't always do this well for whatever reason. They tend to slip, they tend to make mistakes, and sometimes these mistakes that they make lead to tragedies where they could be injured, or an innocent citizen could be injured, or a suspect could be injured unnecessarily. And so I think the key to improving the performance of police officers in terms of reducing the levels of violence between themselves and citizens is figuring out ways to ensure that on a regular basis, police officers exhibit the highest level of sound tactical performance in the field. And one of the things that needs to happen in terms of the cultural shift, in terms of law enforcement being able to move forward with improving the performance of the line officers, which after all are the officers who are most regularly interacting with citizens, is a need to make sound tactical practice a priority of the police organization. And in my written testimony, I point out that this notion of safety culture and the notion of mindfulness is rooted in some literature that explains how it is that people who are working in very high-risk environments can have low levels of negative outcomes. And I just want to briefly talk about the five principles of mindfulness and then the four aspects of safety culture, and then I'll wrap up. Mindfulness consists of five interrelated attributes among members of organizations and organizational units. And the first of these is something called a preoccupation with failure. And that means not resting on your laurels and not saying, gee, everything went well in this interaction, so therefore I don't need to improve it, but trying to figure out what could have gone wrong, looking for the mistakes that were made instead of patting oneself on the back. A second thing is something called reluctance to simplify interpretations. And oftentimes what happens in police field work is officers have to figure out what is going on in a given situation, and they put their imprint on the definition of the situation early on and then don't get additional information that might shift their understanding of what's going on, which excludes the possibility of figuring out alternative ways of resolving something. Then the notion of sensitivity to operations, paying attention to changes in the environment when officers are interacting with citizens, and so that they can then adapt to what is going on in the moment as opposed to hewing to this initial definition of the situation. And then something called commitment to resilience, which means always being alert to the possibilities that problems can arise, and then having a mindset and a capacity to address problems before they propagate. So, for example, if a police officer senses that an individual is starting to get aroused and upset about something, seeking to calm them, that's a commitment to resilience, being able to build into your models with how you're going to interact with people the possibility that you're going to have to use multiple methodologies to resolve a situation. And then finally, deference to expertise. And deference to expertise is simply making sure as a police organization that you have the right people in the given interaction between police officers and citizens. So, for example, if the line officers understand that they're dealing with someone who has in a mental health crisis, and there are mental health services available, either from a crisis intervention trained officer or outside the police organization, getting those people there to assist. And then shifting out of this notion of developing mindfulness and directly into safety culture, and this aligns a little bit with what Chief Slaughter was talking about, is developing a culture that insists that you do the right thing. And one of these things is the notion of a reporting culture. And a reporting culture is a culture where everybody in the organization feels emboldened to notify the powers that be above them if something isn't being done correctly. Not ratting out an officer necessarily, but rather saying, hey, this didn't work itself out well, Sergeant. Let's talk to the Lieutenant and the Captain about how we can do things better. A just culture. A just culture is a culture within the police organization where punishments for mistakes are rare because you don't assume that an officer who made a mistake did so intentionally. Punishments that are meted out when an officer makes a mistake are fair, and organizational members are rewarded for providing information about problems. And that loops back into the notion of reporting culture. And then a flexible culture is a culture where the organization, subunits, and individuals within the organization have the freedom to use the power that they have to adapt to changing circumstances, whether that is in a given situation in the field or whether that is something more generally about how the organization is going to move forward as it recognizes that it's not doing as well as it could, bringing in new policies, procedures, as the chief alluded to. And then finally, a learning culture is one where safety-relevant information is available to all organizations members who might benefit from it. And the key point here is that if a lesson is learned by a small group of officers, let us say under Chief Slaughter's command who are working a particular shift, they don't share that with the rest of the police department, then that lesson gets lost for the rest of the police organization. And so this notion of a learning culture is one where the organization is constantly calling upon the line officers to explain to each other and then to the supervisors throughout the organization, and then it goes to the manager so that it is the organization is constantly learning how to do a better job. I get into some fine-grained detail in my written testimony and then in some of the citations that I listed about how it is that police organizations can develop review panels and how perhaps states and regions could develop review panels to look at situations where police officers engage in forceful action, particularly the use of deadly force, to see if we can learn from things. So not only would the learning organization be just Clearwater, but throughout the state of Florida and throughout the nation, when Clearwater learns something vital about how to improve its performance. And I think that if we can get policing to shift its gaze towards the notion of mindfulness and developing safety culture, that over time, the performance of the police will be better. The effectiveness of the police in terms of resolving potentially violent situations with either no violence or the least amount of violence will go up, and that this will then increase the trust between the police and the polity, which are the two goals of the commission in terms of figuring out ways to increase trust and effectiveness. And finally, if we are able to increase trust, increase effectiveness, what we're going to be able to do is reduce the level of violence between officers and citizens and ultimately save a host of lives, which is what I and many other people in law enforcement have been trying to accomplish for many, many years, figuring out how to reduce the volume of violence, figuring out how to save lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Klinger, for your testimony and certainly for your service. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for Chief Slaughter and Dr. Klinger. Commissioners with questions, please state your name prior to your question and direct that question to the specific panelists or to both panelists. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you. And with that, we'll open up for questions from commissioners. Questions from commissioners for our panelists. The chair has a question in general for our panelists. Previous panelists have discussed the absence of empirical research to support implicit bias. Can you advise us of your knowledge or experience with empirical research that would show implicit bias training does in fact have an impact?
Unfortunately, Lori is the one that's on top of that. What I can say is that in the academic world, concerns about the validity and reliability of implicit bias instruments is something that is up for grabs. And so there is by no means a consensus in the social psychology world about the efficacy of any particular implicit bias instrument to identify precisely what is going on. I don't want to get too deep into the woods, but that's from the academic world. In terms of evidence that it actually improves police performance, that would be a whole different issue. And on that point, one of the sad things that those of us in the academic world have been struggling with literally for decades is the lack of good evidence about a variety of things. So, for example, in my written testimony, I talk about evidence from the Metro-Dade Police Citizen Violence Reduction Project, and that was conducted back in the mid-1980s, mid to late 80s. That was never replicated, so we don't have anything other than that from essentially a generation ago about the effectiveness of that type of tactical training. And then until quite recently, we didn't really have a good notion of what I consider to be the most important aspect of police performance, and that is the use of deadly force. Chuck Ramsey and some other commissioners I know are quite knowledgeable about this fact and have been champions of trying to figure out ways to get better data. We finally are getting some decent data on people who are killed by police bullets, but we still don't have any real good data on the number of people who are shot by the American police or the number of times police officers fire at citizens and miss. And so I know I'm a little bit far afield from your query about implicit bias, but I'm simply trying to say that the lack of sound information about implicit bias in terms of its effectiveness in field operations is mirrored by a lack of information about a lot of things, including the ultimate police action, which is the use of deadly force.
And this is Lori Friedel. I am on the call, although I'm
okay.
In a car. Can I take that? All right. So, yes, no, it's a very good question. And we do have information on the effectiveness of implicit bias training, although not yet with the police population. I mentioned a couple of things that research has shown, and I didn't bring my testimony into the car with me, but people who have had the training are more motivated to be unbiased. They are they have intention to reduce discrimination. They have intention to manage their skills. And then the last thing I said, which is most important, is there are studies that show that implicit bias training can reduce biased behavior. Again, we don't have this information for police populations. We actually expect a couple of evaluations to come out during the summer and the fall. But I want to mirror and reinforce what Dr. Klinger just said, because the ability to detect changes in biased behavior in police in the field is an incredibly tough social science aspiration. So even in those evaluations, even though I do think that we impact behavior in the field, I think it would be very difficult for an evaluation to detect that. I hope that's responsive.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Dr. Zork. Chief Slaughter, we want to give you a chance to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I would like to point out that although I think your question's got merit, I think the value that I receive as an organization from the implicit bias training is the expanded ability to evaluate and to have valuable discussions not only with the public but internally as an organization about the presence of bias. And I even, as we talk to our new officers about it, I even use it as a mechanism for help them understanding others. So a lot of the material is brought forward presented in a manner that is about the actions police take and how implicit bias may impact their decision making. However, I think it's just as important for an officer to understand the person that they're standing across from in the field and the presence that they may have their own certain implicit bias, and not necessarily internalize some behaviors that they may have to deal with in the field. I just know from looking at certain data that we've had, whether or not the bias is accurate, and Dr. Friedel's book even talks about just because the data doesn't looks bad doesn't necessarily mean it's the evidence or presence of bias. But I think in the community and trying to build trust, I think we got to recognize that from the perspective of the community, it very well can be creating a level of distrust that we need to always be mindful of. So the tremendous value that I believe our organization has received from being an early adopter of this training is that it's allowed us, from the management perspective, to look at our practices and make sure that we don't make certain scenarios or situations worse in the eyes of our community and be very prudent and diligent in making sure we demonstrate our commitment to being bias-free. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chief Slaughter. One follow-up question to Dr. Klinger. You mentioned learning culture. Could you cite some examples of agencies that you feel like have a learning culture?
Sure. What I would do is I would drive that down not to a particular agency, but rather to units within agencies. And so, for example, special weapons and tactics teams, at least the special weapons and tactics teams that are good, the ones that that I've met with over the years and spent a lot of time with, whenever they have a situation where they are on a call up, and let's just say it's a generic barricaded gunman who is by himself, and they utilize their negotiation skills and put a little bit of pressure on the suspect, and he surrenders. What they do after that is over is they sit down as a group and talk about exactly what happened, making sure that, for example, the long rifle person and the observer who's with him or her understands what the entry team was thinking about, understands what the negotiators were doing, so on and so forth, and then try to identify points where maybe next time they could do something better. So that would be one example of sub-organizational learning cultures. So far as any particular law enforcement agency that I could point to where up and down the entire chain, that is something that goes on, I'm not aware of it.
Thank you, Dr. Klinger.
Yes, sir.
Commissioners with questions for our panelists.
Could I amend that statement that I just gave, sir?
Yes, sir, Dr. Klinger.
Yeah, there are police departments around the country that are committed to developing learning cultures in terms of their review processes when officers use deadly force, but that's a fairly narrow band. So, for example, the city of Tucson, Arizona, both the LAPD and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Departments, what they have is they have a group that does a tactical review when an officer-involved shooting occurs to try to find points of learning that they can then pass on. However, because officer-involved shootings, fortunately, are quite rare events, there's a whole slew of situations where officers are involved in either lesser uses of force or situations where they were able to resolve a situation short of using deadly force that go by the wayside in terms of having an opportunity to learn from them. And one of the points I make in one of my pieces that I cited in my written testimony is the importance of crafting constant review within the organization about all sorts of things so that you could get true learning culture as opposed to learning culture that is focused on a narrow slice of the actions of your officers.
Thank you, Dr. Klinger.
Mr. Chairman, it's Dan Slaughter. If it's okay with you, I wouldn't mind adding a couple items to this topic.
Chief, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. There's some resources that I think are kind of emerging that are available that are implemented in some organizations. There's a website referred to as Leo Near Miss, in which case officers are able to share contacts and incidences from various levels of police action, whether it's from as simple as a citizen contact all the way up to the application of force. And it does allow for lessons to be learned in a similar format to how the industry and airline industry and the medical industry share stories. Many organizations have internal groups that look at a variety of levels or actions of officers. I know in our organization we have what's called an officer safety committee, in which case we look at police action all the way from a traffic stop up to the use of force levels of to the highest level to evaluate them, to share those experiences and keep the organization improving and the individual employee improving so that they can almost get kind of that critique and kind of hone their skills and learn from the experience. Camden County, New Jersey, just their police department uses body cameras and their strategy to kind of keep the organization learning and moving forward is to evaluate those videos like a professional sports team looks at the game videos, the game tapes. And so there are some really good examples, I think, of organizations that are doing just that, and I think it's going to become more prevalent in the future. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chief. Commissioners with questions for our panelists. Commissioners with questions for our panelists. Hearing no further questions, let me thank our panelists once again for your time and your most valuable testimony and the responses to the questions from our commissioners. On behalf of Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Pisick and Jeff Avita and all the commissioners, your contributions today are most sincerely appreciated and will assist this commission in their deliberations and work. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website. We'll update it regularly when information is available for posting. As I mentioned yesterday, we'll be holding an executive session next Tuesday, July the 7th. Commissioners will be receiving the Outlook calendar invite for this two-hour session, and we will only have one additional hearing next week, which will be on Wednesday, July the 8th. More information on both of these events will be sent later this week. Our last hearing this week will be tomorrow, Thursday, July the 2nd, and we'll hear from panelists regarding the topic of respect for law enforcement. I want to make sure we note for the record, Dean, that Commissioner Roush has joined the call. Commissioner Rouse, our thoughts and prayers are with you.
Thank you.
We also want to once again thank the FBI for the use of their teleconference network and for the support of all of our commission hearings. Are there questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned. Thank you again, commissioners, for your continued dedication and commitment to the work of this historic commission.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation. This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.